Very good. So for this evening's talk, try and keep it something practical, and just reflecting on one of the letters I got last week from a lady in Switzerland. And people do often send a lot of letters, and please remember there's only one of me, there's sometimes hundreds of you, so please don't keep sending letters expecting a reply. It's impossible. But sometimes what you say I'll try and address in a talk, so it's from many, many people rather than just one. This particular girl, she was only, I think, 24, just finished university, got a degree, and wondering what sort of career or job to do in life, because, you know, she was, like many young people, idealistic, and it's wonderful to be idealistic, and how can you keep those ideals, you know, in modern life, and still feel good about yourself and feel you're contributing to the world. At the same time, you know, have enough funds to enjoy your youth and your make a family and everything else which is expected and anticipated by people in today's world. And how can you do that and still keep those important values in your life? And again, sometimes people say to sacrifice your ideals for practical purposes, but that is no soul destroying. It is not a very nice thing for people to do, and certainly as as in my position, I try and encourage people to please keep and preserve your ideals, not just in your youth, but throughout your life. You should all know that I am an idealist. I've kept those ideals over the 60 years. And still some of the things which we have built in this organization, our Buddhist Society of Western Australia, it's been a lot of faith, a lot of belief that if you keep your integrity and if you do keep to those ideals you envisioned when you were young, you can actually achieve them, live them, and show that it is possible. And for those of you who don't know the history of our Buddhist Society, again, I only came here 30 years ago, and at that time we had a tiny house in North Perth, and because I was good at arithmetic and maths, I did look at our accounts when I first came, and the house was worth $50,000, and we owed $49,000 to the bank, and there was hardly any money in the bank accounts, so we were really sort of, you know, starting from absolutely nothing. I know over those years people would come up and say, wow, we never thought you'd make it and actually survive, let alone grow. And sometimes you wonder how you did that. Already you see that we never charge for people coming into this hall. I often tell people that, no, we should never charge for coming into any talk. We can charge for going out if you don't like it, but not for coming in. And a lot of times by keeping that idealistic attitude, yeah, you know, the funds will come eventually. You know, sometimes I mention little scams to raise funds for our nuns' monastery. We know that probably the biggest donation we ever got to our monastery for nuns, which is at Gijigan, sometimes the nuns come and give a talk here. It is, again, part of my idealism to have no distinction between age, gender, sexual discrimination, race or whatever. We try to really live that in a Buddhist society. I've, you know, many times gone out on a limb supporting gays, gay marriage, voluntary euthanasia, you know, the equality in the genders in Buddhism. You know, we do have that here. In other countries they don't have that. But go out on a limb because we want to fight for those ideals. But sometimes the practicalities of raising funds, the best, I think it still remains the biggest donation we ever got for our nuns' monastery. Many, many years ago. It's a beautiful story. Some of you have heard it before, but it just shows when you have a good dream, it comes. When we wanted to start a nuns' monastery, we decided to get a bank account, first of all, to advertise it. But you know what it's like, a dollar here, $5 there. There's not much in the account. Then, you know, to buy a block of land for a monastery is really expensive. But, you know, it was chugging along. The main thing was that people knew about it. And I can never forget one afternoon at the monastery where I live in Serpentine. A man came and he was wearing jeans and a singlet, the sort of person you'd see in a pub. And he came to tell me that his wife had just given birth to their first child, a daughter, and he wanted to do something out of celebration for the birth of his first child. And he'd heard that we were wanting to build a monastery for Buddhist women. And he said, I don't know if my daughter will ever become a Buddhist, let alone wanting to become a nun. But who knows? So I want to make a donation for your nun's monastery. And he handed over a check for $250,000. Just like that. And I've never seen him again. I don't know where he came from, but if he's ever around and he hears this talk, please come and say hello and just to see how far that donation has gone, and maybe you can make another one. But no. It's just to come and say hello. But it was so inspiring that sort of stuff can happen. No, just totally out of the blue, not expecting anything. And he certainly didn't look like a rich man at all. But that sort of idealism, again, has run my life and has run this Buddhist society, where we do dream, and I still dream. And so the 24-year-old who wrote that little letter to me, please carry on dreaming. And never sacrifice your ideals. So what should you do practically? You know, you've got to earn a living. There is something which in Buddhism is one of the core parts of Buddhism, one of the core parts of the Eightfold Path, called right livelihood. And the Buddha actually realized that in the spiritual path, you're going to spend a lot of time at the office, at your workplace. A lot of your life is spent there. And so if it's not suitable, if it's not in tune with your ideals, if it's an unpleasant, what they call toxic workplace, that's going to have a huge effect on your health, both physical and mental. And so it's something which you have to address. And of course, that's why as a leader, try and make a very good workplace for the monks and the nuns and for our Buddhist society and for all the people who come here. And that is why we do have ethics. And this is a very successful, a Buddhist society. It's a very successful monastery, both for men and women. And a lot of it is because the ethos by which that monastery runs. But any one of you who goes down to certainly Bodhidharma Monastery, you can ask for the monastic rules down there. We do have it somewhere. I think it's gathering dust. But when it was written down, just the little rules of what you can do and can't do in a monastery, the most important rule, number one, was called compassion. And I made sure that when we sort of formulated the rules, which are just specific to one monastery, compassion has to be number one. Because I am an idealist, and I realized a long time ago that people are much more important than things. And if you're going to have a spiritual community, even having a Buddhist society here in Nolamara in Perth, the buildings are not so important as the kindness, the compassion, the welcome, which you feel when you come into this place. Yeah, we can have really, really elaborate buildings. We can have an aircon in this room, but would you rather have an aircon and having people being unkind to you, or being a bit warm and uncomfortable, but everyone being happy and caring and welcoming? What is more important, the people or the buildings, the things? And it's little ideals like that which run our company, the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. You are much more important than anything else. And to this day I will say I'd rather have, and I get into trouble from this by some people, dirty toilets, stuff lying all over the place, cracks in the walls. I'd rather have that and happy people than having a perfect looking monastery or temple, which is just so immaculate, like a museum, where people don't feel welcome to come. And I say that, yeah, we do get into trouble because people put a lot of hard work, fixing those cracks and cleaning the toilets and stuff. But I think you're getting the message there. The kindness, the generosity, the peace, that's actually what we stand for. That's what a religion is supposed to be there for. I remember years ago looking up, you know, in the dictionary the meaning of the word church. You know, the church never meant a building. It was just a congregation of people. It was the people who met in these places. That was the meaning of a church. And later on, that meaning of people, it got transferred to the building in which they met. And now we call church people. Church, we call it the building. Forgetting about the people. Even when we first settled in Serpentine, many times, because when we started building our monastery, as you know some of the old stories, we didn't have any place to stay. I literally spent the first night at that place under a tree, on the ground. I did have a bed to sleep on, which was just an old door, but I couldn't find it. The batteries in my torch gave out. I was wandering around an hour and after hour, not finding where I was supposed to be sleeping. There was a blanket there and a pillow. So I just found the nearest tree and slept underneath it at night. And that was my first time at a monastery, at Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpentine. It was really cold, but you could sleep. It was okay. It was a bit of fun, really. But anyway, we didn't have very much there. And people would come and, you know, we'd have a big sign outside in the Buddhist monastery. They'd say, "Where's the monastery?" And they were expecting some building, you know, like you see in sort of Catholic monasteries, some big church or some big accommodation block. And say, "No, this is the monastery. It's the trees. It's the people. It's the atmosphere here. That's the monastery. It's the thing, not the... It's the people, not the things that are important in life." So wouldn't it be wonderful if we could somehow transmit that or take that, carry that through to businesses as well, where people are cared for more than things. Now that is not the usual ethos in many companies. So what are we going to do about that? One of the things we can do about that, and this is a challenge to especially many young people listening to this. It's not just here, because these talks go out around the world, literally. And why don't we start our own companies? There was a group over in UK many years ago, the FWBO, I think they're still going. They started Right Livelihood Communities or Companies. Companies which were going to be run on Buddhist principles, you know, people being more important than things. And the ethics of what you do are vital, so you're not just going to exploit things, exploit animals or exploit people to try and get the profit, but have something a bit more meaningful, and thereby maybe making a change to our world. Because especially if you're 24 years of age, what you want to do is to make this place a better place after your visit to this planet Earth. To actually to make a change. Not many of you will be able to achieve that, but some of you will. And if no one tries, there'll be never any change. So why not start your own companies, your own groups, your own organizations, which are going to be run on Buddhist principles? It may be just a little accounting firm. It may be just a little deli. It may be an IT company, which of course is huge business. An IT company which is run on sort of Buddhist principles. People being more important than things. Compassion being really essential. And really living by that. And it is possible and it can be done and people are actually doing that. You're actually making a change to this world. Because I recall that when I was... even 19 or 20, thinking, what should I do in this life? I did have many opportunities, having a great education. But what I always thought that there was two things which I'd have to fulfill in my life to be satisfied, you know, with my time here. And it was my two career goals. One was, you know, your own personal satisfaction and happiness, which is important in life. Whatever you do in your life, getting married, having a family, or traveling, or whatever you do, it has to be personally satisfying for you. Otherwise, you tend to get depressed, upset, angry, grumpy, and you're a pain in the ass to yourself and to other people as well. It's not a really nice thing to be unhappy. So it's not just your personal prerogative to be unhappy. I know that there's one lady here, I saw her earlier. She was on my recent retreat, and she was grumpy, and she was feeling guilty about being grumpy. So just for her, and it's the only time I've done it, and I won't do it again, I gave her a little certificate, a grumpy license, granting her permission to be grumpy at any time for any reason. But yeah, it's okay to be grumpy, but then it really upsets other people as well. So, one of the important criteria of my career was no personal satisfaction, happiness, peace. But that was never going to be enough. You also had to find a career, a job, a path in life where you could be able to serve others, to make a difference, to create happiness, to heal the problems of other people or the world, or do something. And so that was my two goals in life, personal happiness, but also to be able to create a better world, even in a small way. And of course, companies can do that. We do need banks, we do need bus drivers, we do need people who clean out the sewers, we do need whatever you're doing, engineers or whatever. So number one, don't ever demean your career. Because it's important. You're not just doing this for the salary, for the money. You're actually doing it as a service to the community. And if you can just always remember, it's a service, not just, you know, a way of making money. And then one could understand that this is really quite a wonderful thing to do. Of course, you've got these high-profile jobs. People like being nurses or counselors and therapists. But my goodness, that's really tough work. As many of you are in those professions and know how difficult it can be. But, you know, obviously, learning a bit of spiritual strength, wisdom, kindness can make those compassions far easier. And one of those little techniques which I've taught, I'm just going to put it in here again, is in any of those professions, the most important thing to do is not to cure, not to heal the person, not to take the person out of their depression even. The most important thing to do is to care for them. To care, not to cure. And I was reminded about that last week, because the doctor who generated that story actually came to visit last week. Haven't seen him for a while. Young guy I'd known because his family were original members of our Buddhist society. Go through school, go through university, you know, I'd known him since he was a tiny kid. And then he came to see me because his first patient died. The first one they were looking after passed away, and he was devastated. He wanted to change his career. I can't stand this. He had to tell the husband of the young woman who died that he had no more wife. And the two kids had no mother. And that was such a painful thing to do. I don't want to do that anymore. I can't. It's just too hard. And then I told him, I said, look, your job is not to cure. You'll feel this feeling many times and you'll feel a failure. And you'll feel guilty. It doesn't matter what I say to you about sort of how good you are as a doctor, what other people say to you. You'll always feel guilty when you fail, if you think your main job is to cure. But so if you remind yourself, as a doctor, your main purpose in life is to care, not to cure. To care for the people you're looking after. Then you never need to feel a failure. And anyone who dies, who's your patient, you will know, they will know, they've been cared for. And what a wonderful thing that is. You can feel proud and happy as a success in life. Now this is actually how you can take a career which you may think is so easy and wonderful, which is very, very difficult, and take it and change it into something which has got great meaning, where you can find success in life. So it's not just starting a company and making it perfect. Even in an existing career, in a job, you can change that job, that career. Whether it's a bus driver, you know, a simple job, because there was another guy who just became a bus driver. And he thought, this is such a dead-end job. You know, just driving a buses day to day, what purpose is that? And I said, look, There's always so many people you can cheer up when you saw they come into your buzz, just a smile or whatever it is. I remember just being a lollipop lady, you know, the people who stand at the school crossings. And I remember my favourite lollipop lady I've ever seen when I was going from teaching in London and going to Heathrow Airport in really heavy traffic and people going to work feeling so miserable. And there's this lollipop lady, she was doing like a pole dance with this lollipop, dancing all over the place, and she was really good. And everybody was laughing, they were joking, and it changed everybody's trip to work that Monday morning. So look, all these people we see with their lollipops on the school crossings, they should be trained in dance school before they're allowed to go out there, so that they too can dance and make people happy when they're passing by on their way to work. Little things like that on what you may think is a dead-end job, or an ordinary job, or a boring job. You can always do something little extra to create a bit more happiness, peace and joy into that job. And there you are making it fulfilling. You are creating a little bit of happiness in the tax office, or wherever else you work. Oh, come on, people have to pay taxes. We've got to pay for the hospitals and the roads somewhere or other. So why on earth can't we make that a joyful, happy place? So if that lady wants to join the Inland Revenue Department of Switzerland, go for it, girl. But when you go to work every morning, wear a red nose, wear a fairy suit, whatever else. Be the Patch Adams of the tax office in Switzerland. Make a difference, whatever it is. And I think hopefully you're getting the message of what I'm saying here. A lot of times in life, it's not what you do, but how you do it makes a difference in life. It's not just being a monk. I'm a monk, therefore I'm going to be peaceful and happy from now on. You've probably seen many miserable monks and miserable nuns in your life. And of course, there always will be. It's not what you do, but how you do it makes a success in life. And so whatever this young girl wishes to do in life, just because it's a really good job, maybe working for Greenpeace or doing something which is really important, going out there to Africa or some poor places and reconstructing tsunami-devastated Samoan islands or whatever else this is, yeah, it has a lot of meaning, but a lot of people have done that and they come back disillusioned. They come to tell me, I went out there to just help the world, and it's the people I was working with really, really gave me so much unhappiness. And even in places you would think you should, you know, be inspired, it's again the people you work with, you know, even so working in sort of World Wildlife Fund or whatever, doing something for the world, it's who you work with makes all the difference. And you are the people other people work with. So in order to change the culture of work, the place where, you know, people spend most of their life, don't get other people to change, you have to change. Just like a doctor, the thing is not to cure, it's to care. The thing is not just to make money, it's to make happiness. It's not just to get sort of succeed in life. Is to succeed in peace and happiness. And look, one of the other things which Buddhism is very, very strong on, and I often mention this in conferences, and this is absolutely true. In my position now, I do meet some sort of very senior politicians, even, you know, prime ministers and presidents. And so many of these have actually come and told me, they said, look, you know, we really want to do something to help this world. We've run out of ideas. We just don't know how to fix these problems. And basically they told me, you're a Buddhist monk, a senior Buddhist monk. Help us. Because we've never tried Buddhism before. We never tried some of the Buddhist principles. Is there something in your religion, something this peaceful, happy faith, you know, which we can use in politics, in the real big world, to actually to solve some of these problems, to reconcile, to forgive, to move forward, you know, to balance the budget, to stop going to wars, to stop killing everybody, to get rid of the guns in the United States. Please, we don't know what to do. Help! And I often say that, you know, there's a huge amount which Buddhism can offer here. And one of those little things, it is a radical path. Living more simply. Simple thing like that. Smaller houses. I was very happy to see in an article which somebody sent me, because of the GFC, the global financial crisis in the United States, many people were having very difficulty finding a place to live. It was amazing. The richest country in the world, there were so many homeless people. And these were homeless people who had jobs. But even with their income, they couldn't find a place to live. And so some enterprising companies were working with the local governments to change the planning regulations to allow for smaller dwellings, just like we had in the old days. You know how hard it is to get approval for a small dwelling? Big mansion, easy. Tiny dwelling, it's not big enough. Add a few more rooms. It doesn't fit. So the planners changed the regulations so people could build small houses. And I love small houses because in small houses, not only do you not have to work so hard, you don't have to worry so much about paying off the mortgage. If you lose your job, you're not in the poo trying to find out what you're going to do next. And the best part of small houses is in small houses you meet each other. You're around one another. You've got a family again. Instead of these big houses, which most of you live in Perth right now. So many rooms. How many rooms can you stay in at the same time? Only one. And it's usually one person in one part of the house. Most of your day counts as one person per room. So that's why you never meet anybody. And why even in a family you feel lonely. And why your kids don't learn the social skills of getting on with each other. But that's what you have to learn when you're tightly packed, you know, in a small house, when you can't escape from one another. You have to get on. Isn't that a reason why there's so much social disharmony? Why men and women can't live together? Boyfriends, girlfriends keep busting up, so many divorces. Why is that? One of the reasons is because we've lost the skills in tolerating each other, learning how to live together, learning how to forgive, laugh or whatever. Because those skills which you usually learn when you're young in a house with so many people, well, you have to get on. You learn how that works. There's no escape. Those skills which you learn in small houses have been lost. Which is why going back to small houses is economically good. Takes away a lot of the stress. You don't have to work so hard. You don't need so much money. That's the biggest, you know, part of your income goes into your houses these days. And I mean, you work so hard. And that also means you get so stressed at work. So there's many ways, and again, which Buddhism can help. And it's so effective. I'm saying this, and it's true. Some of the stuff which I've said here on a Friday night has gone into the Harvard Business School blog, been taught in Harvard and MIT. The latest one, which somebody found recently, was lowering your expectations. And I, you know, I've said that for many years. Your expectations of a partner in life, lower them. Otherwise you're going to be so lonely in life. And that means also when your partner lowers their expectations, then you may have one partner as well. And lower your own expectations of yourself. I must say that every week. You don't have to be so strong, so wise, so witty, so good. For goodness sake, just be yourself. Lower your own expectations of yourself. And that goes totally against some corporate culture. You've got sales targets, you've got personal targets, you've got development targets, you've got career targets, you've got financial targets. That sucks big time. That causes so much suffering, trying to live up to something which is just impossible. That's a cause of stress. Not only stress because you keep failing, you lose all your sense of self-worth. You are a failure. even at work, because your boss never says you're good enough, except if your boss is the abbot of Bodhinyana Monastery. Me, I would say, be good enough, it's very good, it will be okay. Now imagine having a boss like that. That is why Bodhinyana Monastery is so successful. Why so many people want to join. That's why you guys keep wanting to come here. How many of you who have been coming here a long, long, long time? How many of you have ever been criticized by me? You stupid attendant, you stupid president, you stupid secretary. I just don't do that. Ask them. Because you want to create a positive culture, and people actually work much harder when they're encouraged rather than they're criticized. One of the stories I tell, because this was given to me, people, you know, you are the source of many of the stories. If you see something interesting, you send it to me, email it to me, or leave it here on a Friday night, because these are inspirational and they're meaningful stories about how you can actually create good business. I still remember the name of this company, Farrelly and Sons. It was an engineering company in the Midlands of UK who won the prize, Best Company of the Year. And the reason they won that prize, I mean, it's quite a few years ago now, was because in 12 months they'd trebled their turnover and doubled their profits. I mean, that's wonderful. To double your profits in 1 year is amazing sort of turnaround for a company. And they did building maintenance and other stuff like that. And their strategy was ingenious. It's sometimes when people actually see the problem and the solution is absolutely simple. Just as an aside, I was just saying this earlier, there was, when I was a young monk in Thailand, there was a problem in the local town of Ubon. That's, you know, in northeast Thailand, where Ajahn Chah's monastery was. There was not enough public toilets. So there was a place in that town where taxi drivers, you know, the tuk-tuk drivers and anyone else who was passing would urinate. It was against a wall. And everybody would go there to urinate, so much the place stank. So the local government put a sign up, please don't urinate here. Did that work? No. They put signs up saying you will be fined if you urinate here. Did that work? No. The place got smellier and smellier until one bureaucrat, and there are some smart bureaucrats, surprise, surprise, put up the sign which works. He just put up a simple sign, urinal for dogs. And no one would use that place ever since. I mean, that's really smart. You know, some people just get it, a simple solution, and solves the whole problem. So this problem of, you know, trying to sort of get their company sort of really on a good financial track, the company did the simple solution, passing this to everyone in their organization, over time was banned. Absolutely. And you couldn't take any work home either. And that was enforced strictly. Now what was the result of that? What do you mean we don't get as much work out of you? It's not the time you spend in the office. It's the efficiency of that work. How much time do you waste at work? Sometimes because you're tired. Sometimes because of office politics. Sometimes because you're grumpy, you're upset. I spend a lot of time thinking negative thoughts. And maybe it's because you do have problems with your family. If you spend too much time in overtime, you don't even spend time with your family. Your wife, your kids hardly see you. Which means you have divorces, problems with your kids at school, all sorts of stuff. Which takes away a lot of your time and energy worrying about really important things in your life. You go to work with those worries. Is that going to make you an efficient worker? So this was a wise strategy. Let's ban overtime so that everybody goes home, rests. They can't take work home with them. Rests and have time with their family every evening. Quality time. And they come to work in the morning, which means they don't bring their worries and their tiredness into the workplace with them. They've had a good rest, got a good family life. And how important that is for your success in life. The family life is actually your basis, you know, from where you can sort of launch off into your career. Without that sort of bedrock of a very supportive, happy, you know, nurturing family, you go out there into the workplace and you're really struggling. Wouldn't that be wonderful? You go home and, you know, the family is there welcoming everybody, nice people who know how to get on with each other. Half the arguments in a family, and you should know this by now, it's nothing to do with people, it's just because you're so tired. So tired and grumpy, not enough time to sort out and be with each other. That lack of time is one of the biggest killers of family life. And also, you know, child problems, drug abuse, whatever else happens in our young people. So imagine you come home every evening, on time, early, spend time with each other, have a dinner together, sit down, talk things over, and have time with the kids and not off in their room because they haven't got a room. They, you know, you have to share with everybody, small house. And then, in the morning, you go to work fresh, which means, yes, you don't spend as much time at your office because you don't do overtime. But my goodness, that time is efficiently used. You're fresh, you're sharp, you're positive. Office politics, you know, the stuff which cripples companies, diminished. Absenteeism, sick leave, diminished. And the turnover, the staff turnover went to zero. No one wanted to leave. They were actually happy at their workplace. What a wonderful thing that is, to go to work, looking forward to going to work on a Monday morning. Woohoo! Monday morning again, I can go to work. How many of you think like that? Wouldn't it be wonderful? That means that positive attitude goes there. And we all know that staff turnover is a huge drain on the company's ability to perform. Usually, I was told it takes about 6 months to train somebody up to that job which you were doing before. And that 6 months, basically they're not performing. So it's wonderful to be able to have a pot. So that's why this company, just very good ideas, caring for people, basically getting the most out of them in a shorter time, where everybody would win. And they were so positive that, of course, their clients, suppliers, which people tell me in business, and I know this from my business of looking after a monastery, now the plumbers, the bricklayers who build our monastery, these are friends. Just the last few days ago, you know, got the plumber. I hadn't seen him for years. He still remembers me when we first started doing things. And so because he remembers me, oh, Brahm, yeah, I can fix that up for you. They come straight away. How hard is it to get a plumber here in Perth? They come to give a quote. And they give a quote, and they'll be back in 3 weeks. In the meantime. Yes, I rang this guy on Monday, he was there on Wednesday. No, he actually finished the job on Wednesday. Now that's really efficient stuff. Why? Because he's a friend. He's worked before, we got a relationship together. Now those relationships in business, that's actually what gets things done. All these business gurus tell me, yes, exactly, it's forming those relationships, forming those friendships, that trust. That's actually how business works. This is what Buddhist business is all about. How many times you've come here and I told you how to form those relationships? It's not about you, it's not about me, it's about us. It's what goes on between us. Don't think about me, don't think about them, think about us. It's a relationship. The Emperor's Three Questions story, which I keep on talking about. Now is the most important time. The one in front of you is the most important person in the whole world. Do that in business and you'll be highly successful. It's being in the moment, giving respect to the person in front of you, being now, not worrying about the future, what you've got to do next. That person, that client, that surprise are right in front of you. And care. Simple teachings, the Emperor's Three Questions. And that, I tell that a lot of business schools where I give talks. So I give talks in all sorts of places, and it actually works. A simple philosophy like that, caring, one in front of you is the most important person, in other words, being in this moment, now, that is a powerful teaching which enhances the work experience. So it means all these jobs actually become great places to work. It's not the career. Sometimes people say lawyers. You know, there's all these lawyer jokes. And I won't say lawyer jokes. I tell you enough bad jokes here. I'll not say that today. I'm tempted. No, I better not. But, because be careful telling jokes about lawyers, because sometimes they could sue the Buddhist Society. But anyway, all these lawyers jokes. Why has lawyers got such a bad reputation? Even politicians. Why have politicians got such a bad reputation? Because they've got a bad reputation, it means no one wants to become a lawyer, or a politician, which means we don't get the cream of the crop to run our countries. That's not a good way to live. So wouldn't it be wonderful if we can actually change ethoses? Yeah, we have to have politicians, we have to have lawyers. Wouldn't it be great if we did have a politician who actually stood up and actually never, ever would say anything bad about somebody else? This was a philosopher once told me, actually I read it from a philosopher, and he said, you never overcome a bad idea by criticizing it. You only overcome a bad idea by presenting a better idea. That's a beautiful little posse. So Tony Abbott, Julia Gillard, all these other people, please don't go trashing the other policies, the policies of the other side. Put forward better policies. People will respect you so much more. Not only that, that was written in stone by the Buddhist Emperor Asoka in India with reference to religions. Any religion, he said, which demeans or curses or criticizes another faith only succeeds in diminishing their own faith. You hurt your own faith by criticizing others. You hurt your own credibility by trashing other people's policies. Why do we do that? It's obvious. You should never do that. Just, aren't you embarrassed about our political systems? Most Australians, English, everybody, we're all embarrassed about the way our politicians behave. So we can actually take these careers, take these businesses, take these pathways which young people are going to face in life, and we can change them. Don't think that things cannot be changed. Myself with a few other people in tow, we've changed a lot about Buddhism. You go to Thailand where I came from, you see the Buddhism where I came from, it's not quite the same as you see here. This is far more tolerant, far more open. As one lady said, in Thailand you can never come close enough to a monk to ask them their questions. And even finding out what Buddhism is or meditation in a place like Thailand, he said you can't get through the smoke screen from the incense. There's so many rituals, and the same a lot is in Sri Lanka too, and in Burma. There's so much traditions, it's like a big wall, and you just can't find what the essence of Buddhism is. And that's why over here you can actually put aside all that tradition, all that chanting, all those amulets and all that holy string and all this other stuff which most people think is Buddhism, and get to the heart of it. These teachings you're hearing right now. What work, what changed your life and what changes the world and makes that your career in whatever industry, whatever place you're actually working in, you can change that environment totally. Change politics, change law. And especially for people much younger than me, I've changed a little bit of the world in which I've lived. So please, you do the same. But don't be so ambitious, because of course, when you're young, you do want to change the whole world. But one of the moments which changed me was when I was with this senior monk in England. I was just being his attendant on a retreat, and I remember this very clearly, like most of the turning points of your life. I was on a retreat in this old fishing village called Oban in the north of Scotland. Anyone who knows that part of the world, it was picturesque. About 25 years ago, no, more than that, before I came here, 30 years ago, 32 years ago. He was teaching a retreat. There's only a few people on this retreat. But at the interview time, I was just being the attendant, just like these two monks beside me, just sitting quietly listening. And this woman came in, and I thought she was going to ask another meditation question. Why can't I stop thinking? Why can't my butt keep on hurting? Whatever it is in meditation, the usual stuff. And then she asked, she didn't ask a question, she said, I've just come here to thank you for saving my life. And she said it with such sincerity. Just, you know, I literally woke up and said, what? What has this monk done to save your life? And then she told the story that she had been on the previous retreat there the year before. And she had an addiction to Valium. She was a student in the 60s, and when anyone had any little problem, social problem, emotional problem, the doctor at the university would just give them some Valium tablets to calm them down. A quick way of getting them out of the surgery. For many people it worked, but for some, like her, she got addicted. And addicted to this antidepressant drug which just put her mind in a cloud. And she, when she came on this retreat, she heard about the Buddhist precepts, one of which is we're not supposed to take alcohol or drugs. Now that means non-medicinal drugs, and if you're on meds for schizophrenia, please keep taking them. You know, if you're on insulin for diabetes or your heart, please, we don't want you to die. But she didn't understand that, so she thought, oh my goodness, I can't take my Valium. So for the 9 days of the retreat, she just didn't take any tablets. And because it was a meditation retreat in a very beautiful, peaceful place, she could sort of handle it. She could handle the withdrawal symptoms because it was so supportive and so calm. At the end of the retreat, she had to go home. And she said she had to go through Glasgow railway station in a busy European terminal. If you've ever been to a station or an airport, it's this crazy place. And she said she almost totally lost it. She managed to get on the train and find her way home, just simply because of teachings like, you know, this too will pass. You know, open the door of your heart to yourself. These beautiful teachings. That got her through to get home. Where she said she spent the next 2 weeks just sitting in an armchair. She couldn't do anything. Just waiting for the effects of this drug to go off. She managed 9 days. She managed a month. She was free. She said, you wouldn't know what it's like unless you've been in those drug-induced stupors to know that now she is free. The freedom which you take for granted, the ability to think, to feel, to hear the sound of the birds, to feel the wind when they're not so muted and dulled out. She could do that now. She was alive. And that's why she said, thank you for saving my life. And that meant so much to me. I remember it to this day. And at that time, I made my resolution. If one person in my whole life comes up to me and says that, thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for saving, just one person, my life has been fulfilled. That was the meaning of my life. To try and get that one person to say that you have saved me. That one person came a long time ago. I've been followed by hundreds of others. That is the meaning of the life. That's why I'm very happy. I have got that fulfillment. So that 24-year-old girl, that is your job. It's not just to work in the company. It's not just to have a nice family and kids, which is really important. But it's also to make a difference. So one person, 2 people, 10 people, I don't care how many, but get the one first of all, can come up to you and say, thank you. If it wasn't for you, I'd be dead. I would have committed suicide. I'm going over the time, but this is, I hope this guy's listening to this. He lives over in Beverly. He was an old caretaker of our centre here. He left to have a nice, peaceful time up in Beverly. But, you know, we all go through difficult times. He went through a depression. And he got so depressed, he actually went into his shed and tied a rope to the rafter, tied a noose, got the chair ready, and went into the caravan where he was staying to write his suicide note. He had the radio on at the time, just the local radio. And as he was writing his suicide note, now just halfway through, who would come on the radio? Ajahn Brahm. And he thought, oh no, I can't do anything without this monk getting in the way. So he ripped up his suicide note, untied the rope, and came and told me about it afterwards. He said, it's really too difficult to commit suicide. You even get on the radio and stop me. That's another guy I've got who saved his life. So it's amazing, just when you do things like that, you feel fulfilled. Now, I haven't told what actually is right livelihood, whether it is working for an environmental company or working for BHP and taking stuff out of the ground, or whether it's working for the police department or London Mention Lawyers, or becoming a monk or a nun. It does not matter so much. It does matter a little bit, because sometimes people do get exploited, but if you can get that right culture in the office, that kindness, people are important in the whole company, then you will get companies making munitions and bombs. It's not the ethos of the company. People are important. That comes right from the heart of the company, from the people who work there. So why can't we start some Buddhist companies? Or if not, even better, infiltrate existing ones. Be moles to change the culture of the companies of our world. Otherwise, what sort of world are we going to get? You know, it's not really the governments who hold most of the power these days. It's the companies, especially the multinationals. They're made up of people. People like you, people like me. Why can't you be that people? And actually change those multinationals. Little by little. Starting with a very good little work environment. Which is, it works, that's the thing, you don't have to sacrifice anything. That company which banned overtime, they made more money. It always is win-win situations. Most of the time, everybody wins. Which means you don't have to really worry too much about sacrificing things. And that way we can make a better world. This is some idea of, I'm not talking about you today. Usually I just talk about how you can be personally developed and become a better person. But this is actually about where you work, where you spend a lot of your time, to make that a more fulfilling place. And a place where you can find personal fulfillment and make a difference to our world. And of course, only scratching the surface, but we're getting over time. But that is especially for the young lady who wrote to me from Switzerland, just on that point of where she's going to make her life, what sort of career, what she's going to do. A challenging you. Make a difference. It's hard, it's a sacrifice, but you feel so fulfilled. You will live a happy life, and when you get to an age like mine, you look back and say, yes, we did something. And then you will be very peaceful and fulfilled. Thank you for listening. Very good. Okay, questions or comments about tonight's little talk? Are there any questions from the internet, or is it not broadcast tonight? Okay, it's not. Okay, I hope it's recorded, because I want to send a copy to the person. Sometimes it's not streamed live, but it's always recorded, I hope. Is it recorded? Yes? Yeah. And then it can actually be sent over afterwards. Any comments or questions this evening? Wow. Okay, yeah, one question. Oh, Namotassa is just what we say, Namotassa Bhagavato, is just like a homage to the Buddha. It's a Buddhist chant. But the reason I said that for the meditation, it does not, try and get something you don't understand the meaning of. Because if it's something you understand the meaning of, you start thinking about it. So it's something you haven't got a clue what it means, some nonsense words, it's much better to make you silent. So you say that, may the whole world be at peace. Then you start thinking about how you're going to make it at peace. It doesn't work that way. So just make it something you don't understand. So please forget the explanation I just gave you. Okay. So any other questions or comments? Okay. Oh, yeah. Yes, go on. Ah, yeah, what if she gets so caught up in trying to make a difference, she's not going to be happy? You'll know that if that's you, and you're trying to make a difference, and you forget about yourself, you are causing more problems in the world. the only difference you make is just make things worse. That's why I'm saying it's not about you, it's not about me, it's always about us. A company is a group of people, it's not individuals. It's a team, it's a family. It's never about me, it's never about you, it's always about us. That's the meaning of a relationship, that's the meaning of a company. That's one of the reasons why hierarchies, that's one of the things we really try to stop in these monasteries over here. One of the reasons why, you know, even Bodhinyana Monastery in Dharamsala is quite successful. We've got a few hierarchies, you know, who gets the food first, but that's about it. Look at the way he's laughing. If it was a hierarchy, he would never laugh like that. That's good. And businesses are just too hierarchical. And sometimes families are too hierarchical. Who's the boss in your relationship? If there is one, you're stuffed. Please, no bosses. It's us. We are the boss. We. And that's actually, this is true, straight down the line Buddhism. The community in a monastery is the boss, not the abbot. I can be outvoted any time. The community, they call it the Sangha. The Sangha is a word for a monastic community. The Sangha is the highest. The Sangha rules. The Sangha is the boss. So we don't have... You know, sometimes I go to the Benedictine monastery in New Norcia. There, the abbot is the boss. They have rules of obedience. We have rules of disobedience in my monastery. In other words, it's a democracy. We all sort of come together and decide what to do. And that's absolutely true. Hierarchies kill business. And you all know that, because hierarchies, you spend most of your working life trying to get up the hierarchies. What are you doing that for? So, can we take a lot of hierarchies out of our world? Especially out of our business world. Interesting. See if that can be done. Okay, so thank you. I don't know if I answered the question. I think I went off on a tangent, but never mind. So let's actually now compare respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. And those who want to ask some more questions, you're more welcome. Most